Railway Cottages, Effingham Junction. Revised June 2011 from the original taped interview held at the Sir Douglas Haig Hotel on September the 15th, 2010. Themes: living at the junction, village childhood, school days, war years, cricket club, and Horsley Towers. My name is Michael Waller. I was born 1930 in the village of West Horsley. Our house, named Cantara, was semi-detached with all mod cons. Cantara, the house my father named after his First World War Army base in the Middle East, and where I was born in 1913, West Horsley. To eke out the family budget, lodgers were taken in, including two policemen. I was the baby in a family of three, having a sister, Mary, and brother, Morris, each 6 and 5 years older, respectively. For promotional reasons, my father, a Southern Railway signalman at East Horsley Station, accepted a vacancy at Effingham Junction, including railway accommodation, namely number 2 station cottages, an early 1900s semi-detached house with no mod cons, and to where we moved in 1934. Looking back at the common, which was gated in the 1920s, railway cottages are seen on the right-hand side, and this is a view from Effingham Junction Station towards the common. The wagon was used to carry timber to a Cobham sawmill. My first girlfriend, Margaret Blackwell, she lived at number 3 railway cottages and whose garden backed onto ours. The accommodation at station cottages comprised 3 bedrooms, 2 upstairs and 1 downstairs, which was a lean-to side addition, a scullery, 2 living rooms and an outside toilet. The main 4 rooms were approximately the same size, 12 by 10. The scullery had a higher sloping ceiling, a built-in corner concrete solid fuel burning copper, 1 porcelain sink with cold water tap, a wooden latched and bolted back door, 1 gas light and gas stove, plus a slot meter. The concrete copper was later dismantled because it proved more efficient to boil water in saucepans on the gas stove. Baths were taken in a long galvanised bath in the scullery once a week. The luxury of an Ascot instant hot water gas geyser was a later acquisition at the sink for general washing and shaving purposes. My father contrived a pulley clothes hanger dryer for the mangled washing. Carpets were hung on the outside clothesline and beaten for dust and dirt removal. The living room contained a cast iron range with mantelpiece over, which comprised an oven and grate. It was a built-in shelving and cupboard unit one side and a room for sideboard on the other. There were two easy and one occasional chairs, a dining table and chairs, and a central gas light. Incidentally, electricity didn't arrive until the mid-50s. The range emitted much heat once it got going, warming up the room, and the toasting fork was frequently used. The range was later replaced by an open tiled fireplace, and a wooden partition formed the inside wall and concealed the stairs, which gave way to a curtained off stair access leading to a small top landing with facing cupboard and bedroom doors either side. A rear vertical sash window admitted light to the stairwell and afforded a south-facing view to the garden. The living room door led to a small vestibule with an outside front door, plus a larder under the stairs, complete with mice. And then passing through another door into the front, or best room, was a cast iron open fireplace, three easy chairs with well-worn springs, one occasional table, a central gas light, and an upright piano. The chimney had to be swept prior to having some roaring log fires, especially at Christmas. At other times in the winter, an oil stove heated up a rather chilly room. A gas fire was installed later, which meant no more inviting log fires. The downstairs bedroom had a high sloping roof with an inbuilt ventilator brick at its apex, allowing external sounds to echo through, especially trains coming and going, plus early morning calls from one of our very vocal cockerels. The bedroom also had a small cast iron open grate fire with a birds and cherries motif surround. The outside toilet adjacent to the back door could be an inconvenience by being trapped in there while visitors or stray tradesmen stood chatting and having to wait before emerging. Inside the toilet was a wooden bench seat with hinged front flap for bucket access. Strips of newspaper magazines hung from a nail in the wall. The household chores, being very arduous with so much hard work, I marvel how my mother was able to cope. But she kept the house, everything well organised and spotless, and also with her excellent cooking, she made it from a house into a comfortable home. Pastimes, and we used to play bagatelle, darts, cards, and in the street we played hopscotch and spun tops. In the summer, we walked to Wisley and bathed in the lake. and also fished in the river at Cobham and Ripley. I remember posters advertising an appeal to raise funds for the building of the new Guildford Cathedral. Knitting needles were used for rolling and folding newspapers for firelighters, and rug making was also an occupation. The front, side and rear garden, tended by my father, contained flowers, fruit and vegetables. Damsons from our tree made excellent homemade jam, as did crab apples and blackberries from the common. Chickens were kept, Rhode Island and Reds, giving us eggs. And I remember at one time I purchased a dozen day-old chicks from Watanabe's chicken farm at Hatchford, where we went potato picking in the autumn. These chicks, White Sussex, turned out to be all cockerels, so no eggs, but some delicious roast dinners. My father constructed a sturdy wooden shed from railway sleepers to house our bikes and garden tools. In the bedrooms, candles and night lights were necessary for illumination. And in the winter, the rooms could be freezing with frost forming on the inside of the window glass. Hot water bottles and heated bricks inside a sock preheated the beds. When we first moved in, the three of us shared a double bed, and I remember summer nights lying awake listening to nightingales singing from the woods opposite through the open window. Leatherhead and Guildford by train were our shopping and cinema towns. My mother shopped at the Co-op in Leatherhead. I often cycled to the Savoy Cinema in Cobham and remember seeing The Great Dictator with Charlie Chaplin. Our annual holiday, 1 week, was taken in Exmouth, Devon. And remember getting excited as the time grew near. The journey by steam train took about a day, changing at Exeter onto the branch line, then Eureka, my first glimpse of the sea. 1 year there, my father was stung by a jellyfish, causing him severe leg swelling and making it unable for him to travel, which meant we had another whole week in Exmouth. What joy for us, but not for him. Enjoying myself at the seaside in Exmouth. Back to the junction. Weekends in the summer, Stop Me and Buy One, Wool's Ice Cream Man, took up his stance opposite number 2 at the Common by the then local bus stop. He used to pay my mother 6 months a time for jugs of tea. Us children practically lived on the Common, playing in the bracken, climbing trees, primrosing and bluebelling in the woods, having picnics. A favourite was hunting for empty R. White lemonade bottles, yielding a penny refund each for sweet money. I remember a duck moorhen pond on the common where eggs were nested and frog spawn collected in jam jars. On the other side of the bridge to number 2, the Searle family ran a sweet shop post office called The Halt. It had a tiled step-down approach, the shop being of a framed and panelled construction, with display windows either side of the glass entrance door. On entering the shop, the doorbell sounded, summoning counter service from the rear, which entailed a walk through a linked passageway, making for a delay if nobody else was in the shop being served. The halt had a hall at the back where Mrs. Searle used to rent out the hall for old-time dances and various social functions. I remember we were playing on the common one day when we came across boxes of chocolates, black magic, Cadburys, all sorts of confectionery and sweets, lemonade bottles, etc. It turned out that the halt had been burgled. The local bobby, PC Woods, with his bike, used to stand on point duty outside the halt by the telephone kiosk, but he missed that one. Some of our shop favourites there were Lion's fruit pies in a square box, Mars bars, sherbet dips and fizzy drinks, Corona and Tizer, and lemonade powder, which made excellent still homemade lemonade. I remember my father giving us pennies to go up to the shop and buy a Mars bar, which was a real treat. Turning left at the crossroads by the Lord Howard into Forest Road towards Horsley, first on the left was Stoneley's garage, where our wireless accumulators were taken to be charged. Next came Flax Paper Stationery Shop, which was later Marshall's Fishmongers. A well-known local lady, Miss Poupart, lived on the right-hand side in a detached house. A tall, quietly spoken person, rather old-fashioned, who retained guardianship of the Memorial Hall door key required by us when we went to play table tennis there. Her name is linked to Poupart's Junction, which is on a nameplate on a signal box just outside Clapham Junction. She hosted whist drives and various social gatherings at her house. She also had two lodgers by the name of Musselwhite. Very smart gentlemen in Homburgs suits and spats, they were regularly seen out walking together. Further along the road, on the right-hand side, is the Roland Lubbock Memorial Hall, the hub of social activities at the junction. This is a photograph of the ladies' Bible class, the Covenanters, outside the Memorial Hall. In the front row, holding the shield, is Miss Jenkins, the organist. At the back of her is Sister Clark, and to Sister Clark's right is my sister. Another photograph with Miss Jenkins and Sister Clark in the front row. My sister is fourth from the right in the back row. Proceeding along Forest Road past the Memorial Hall, we come to the railway bridge, and on the right hand side a turning off which was known as the Slip, a shortcut to East Horsley, where I often cycled along to visit my aunt who lived in West Horsley. Yvonne Arno, well-known actress and concert pianist, lived with her husband in a large detached house with green tiles between Effingham and Bookham Commons. A private road to the property, which included a pig farm, led under the Branch Line Railway Bridge, terminating in double gates. We used to collect acorns for the pigs. And the Yvonne Arno Theatre in Guildford. An actor by the name of Desmond Tester lived in Surrey Gardens and appeared in two films which are still repeated on television today, namely The Four Feathers and The Drum, and which are still shown on TV repeats with his name in the credits. Another character by the name of Dijon used to fantasize about his imaginary acting days and the stars he said he knew. He walked with a stoop with his hands behind his back, religiously there and back on Sundays to attend Mass at the Catholic Church in the village. A professional acting teacher, Winifred Outon, lived in Hathaway Cottage, Surrey Gardens. She took an interest in local amateur dramatics and ran rehearsals for the local society, which later became known as the Nomads. Another actor who used to catch the last train down from Waterloo and have a taxi waiting for him at the junction. He was often a bit worse than wear for a drink. His name was Andreas Melandrinos. He used to have bit parts in films like waiters or innkeepers, something like that. He was probably Greek. A cinder path between Number 2 and the Common provided a shortcut to Horsley, emerging at the south side of the railway bridge in Forest Road. Names living along there at the time were Blackwell, Fuller, Warlan, station master, next to the railway sheds, then Carr, followed by a bungalow named Home We Go, where the Tyrrells lived. Mr. Tyrrell, a keen gardener, designed and landscaped a very attractive ornamental garden. Before the path bends right, on the left-hand side was Garnett's farm. Mr. Garnett delivered his milk carrying two stainless steel hinged lid milk canisters from which he ladled milk into customers' jugs. This was before Curtis and Co-op started to deliver milk. In his peak cap and leather gaiters, hobnailed boots and smoking a pipe, he struck a very familiar rustic figure. He owned a rather unfriendly dog chained to its kennel, which was given a wide berth when visiting. The railway houses along the Ockham Road, numbered 1 to 20, with woodland opposite where we sometimes played, some names recalled living along there, were Thornton, Mitchell, Goddard, Smith, Trish, Barnes, Pettit, Osborne, Weston, Jackson, Gould. A bungalow and field at the end was owned by Miller. His wife, Mrs. Miller, ran a sweet shop at Old Lane. Names recalled along there were Phillips, Hemus, Stocks, Gorman and Meach. We played in Barnsthorne's Woods at the back of Old Lane. Our neighbours at number one were Mr. and Mrs. Jim Ponsford. Jim was also a signalman and they had two daughters, Vera and Enid. I was often in their garden and used to carve my initials in his young pumpkins and marrows, which expanded on growing. Jim took pride in his garden, which was indeed a picture, and he used to take his dog Jip for regular walks on the common. Pottering about in his shed with him, I sometimes received a friendly rebuke of "get out of the tent" when I got in his way. On the common local to Orchard Close lived a recluse by the name of Miss Bretherton. We used to name her Stinkbomb. She lived in an old overgrown cottage, and also she owned a house opposite where she kept cats in cages. Rumour had it that she was an actress at one time. Apart from that, nobody else seemed to know much about her. There used to be various tradesmen and con men knocking at our front door. As well as the rag and bone man, there was the onion man. And I remember these onions strung from the handlebars of his bike. School days. At the age of five, I began school at the St. Lawrence Primary School in the village. My mother transported me there and back, sitting on the carrier of her bicycle. Sometimes I used to walk home, which was about 1.5 to 2 miles, without seeing a passing car. And on reaching Indian Farm, if I saw a white Austin van in the distance, I knew there was a possible chance of a lift for the rest of the way from Bowman's Baker on his delivery rounds. Stuart Adams was the headmaster and his wife the governess. Other teachers there being Miss Dixon, Miss Parker and Miss Hardiment. There were 4 classrooms, 2 in the original building and 2 in a newer section, one of which was upstairs. One day, I remember Miss Parker took me to lunch at the Crossroads Cafe and remember having mince and potatoes, which evidently didn't agree with my young constitution. And later that afternoon, during lessons, I had to be excused and go to the outside toilet across the playground on a freezing cold day. And I remember there was snow on the ground. I seemed to be out there for ages, shivering, and eventually had to be rescued by Miss Parker. Miss Hardiman, a very pleasant, buxom teacher, in addition to teaching general subjects, also played the piano and liked to have us gather round for a traditional sing-song. On a Friday, she concluded the week and the class by reading us stories by Enid Blyton. Anthracite stoves heated the classrooms in winter and emitted a warm red glow. Taking turns to fetch the school milking crates from Curtis Dairy, bottles were then placed around the stoves to warm the milk. some of us preferred the ice, which formed into the cream by the frost. A visit to the local blacksmith, watching horses being shod and hearing the clang of hammer on anvil, became a regular attraction. And the local tuck shop was Love's, on the corner opposite the church. Scripture classes saw some canvas scrolls being rolled out depicting religious scenes, one of which I remember was the Last Supper. The local bus used to park and wait outside the Sir Douglas Haig before making its return journey to the junction, then on to Guildford. Stuart Adams occasionally included practical demonstrations, especially in arithmetic, using weights and measures and scales, weighing out cuts of meat, thereby making the subject more interesting. And in geography, he said he'd visited every county in England. He often asked me to fetch his cucumbers from Mizzen's nursery down the road. In spring, we were taken for nature walks, and behind Curtis Farm was a field where we played cricket. The school grounds also included a field, which now has a school extension built on it. This was fenced off by iron railings and gated, closed in winter. Spring made it accessible to the smell of newly mown grass, beckoning the welcome onset of warmer days, and where lessons were sometimes taken in a group sitting on the grass in the sunshine. Stuart Adams was a very charismatic person of medium stature, with slightly florid features, often wore a brown plus four suit, horn-rimmed spectacles, a trilby hat tilted at a jaunty angle, and brogue shoes, and smoked cigarettes. I noticed his fingers were quite nicotine stained. Sir Barnes Wallace, of Bouncing Bomb fame, also lived in Effingham and was an acquaintance of his. On Empire Day, I remember, we enjoyed half day's holiday. About the age of 10, I was transferred to the more modern Central School. Initially, Stuart Adams temporarily took charge until Mr. Hewitt was appointed headmaster. The school grounds there comprised two playing fields, asphalt playgrounds, and allotments. An indoor swimming pool at the lodge nearby was made available to the school. An austerity wartime Christmas party was organised at the school, including a dinner of sausage and mash. Generally, school dinners were very good, and my mother became one of the volunteer helpers in the kitchen. In the war years, the school had to be shared with a London school known as the Strand, which meant for some time we had lessons in the morning only. The war years. When Chamberlain announced we are at war with Germany on September the 3rd, 1939, my mother cried, because the memory of the First World War in which my father served was still fresh in her memory. And as a 9-year-old at the time, the seriousness of the war and what went on in it, we didn't really know much about because we were too busy growing up. The Ponsfords next door took in two girl evacuees, Sheila Brown and Rita Simmons, neither of whom had ever been to the countryside before. So the first question they asked were, are there any snakes here? This photograph shows my sister at the back, Sheila Brown on the left, myself and Rita Simmons. However, they soon integrated with us country bumpkins, enjoying ourselves on the common. Double British summer time in force at that time meant longer, lighter evenings for staying out and playing. But 7 o'clock bedtime was strictly adhered to by my mother's call. I recall laying awake in bed in a downstairs bedroom and enviously hearing the others still playing on the common and allowed out to continue. At the start of the phony war, air raid practice warnings were sounded by banging a suspended railway buffer acting as a gong. Prior to the Home Guard, LDV armbands were worn, local defence volunteers, and they mostly consisted of railwaymen. Parades were held on the common. This was before being issued with rifles and uniforms, and broomsticks or similar were used, causing us children much amusement. Returning home on the train from Leatherhead one evening in the blackout, the train stopped before the station to allow the main Waterloo line train priority. Thinking it was at the station, I opened the carriage door, stepped out, and finished up at the bottom of the railway bank, followed by a voice, "What are you doing down there?" from Ben Barnes, the guard. I clambered back up and he pulled me into the guard's van. "You won't be doing that again in a hurry," he said, and I thought, "Don't bank on it." In the 40s, my father was temporarily transferred to Hampton Court Level Crossing Signal Box. This involved a long bicycle ride there and back, possibly a round trip of 15 miles or so. And with air raids on the go at the time, my mother became quite concerned for his safety, especially at night. Eventually he returned to the junction, and living so close to the station could be a bit too convenient at times, especially when last minute call-outs made it necessary for him to stand in for an absent shift who didn't turn up. This is a photograph of Effingham Junction signal box. You can just see the railway sheds on the left-hand side. My father is standing at the back with his cap on the right-hand side. On Sundays, my mother plated up my father's roast dinner if he happened to be on duty, and she tied it up with a tea cloth with a knot at the top, which made it handy for me to take it over to him and deliver it to him at the signal box, walking along the platform, which caused much banter from the porters. My father served 48 years with the Southern Railway and retired with a nervous condition affecting his hands, caused by years of lever pulling. Getting back to the war, a bomb missed the local substation and landed nearby during the night. And not hearing a thing, I woke up next morning covered in plaster and dust from the ceiling. A field in Garnet's farm sustained a large bomb crater caused by a landmine. The doodle bugs were something else. Canadians in a jeep came over the bridge one day just as one of these things cut out its engine, and with much screeching of brakes and cursing they all dived into the ditch. This was followed by an explosion somewhere near Ockham. One also landed on a house in Windy Ridge, and rumours had it that the occupant was in the bottom of the garden and survived, and another was that one person was killed. During the Blitz, walking up to the railway bridge and looking towards London, the sky was a complete red glow, with searchlights scanning the skies. One became familiar with the throbbing drone of enemy aircraft during an air raid, so it was quite comforting at times that sometimes the noise turned out to be a train. The anti-aircraft gun on the cricket ground caused quite a vibration and noise when in action. Quite often, service personnel stranded off the last train from London knocked on our door requiring a night's lodging. Some we obliged, some were too inebriated. One, who was blind drunk, laid down in the middle of the road on the brow of the hill, quite oblivious to any possible oncoming vehicle. But he was visible from our bedroom window. We managed to go out there and pull him to one side, and a taxi was arranged. He eventually, he evidently lived in Bookham. The British Army unit occupied a purpose-built hut on the common, opposite number two. They all became very friendly and invited us to their Christmas party. The hut was gaily decorated, paper chains, etc., and heated by a cast iron, solid fuel burning stove. Electricity was provided by a diesel generator. A good time was had by all. Canadians were camped off Beach Avenue in the village, and remember having a dinner of mince and tatties from a jerry can with them. They also gave us their penknives. A Molotov bread basket landed on the common, dispersing its contents of unexploded incendiary bombs. They were each about 3.5 inches diameter by about 18 inches long, with fins. Two of us went looking for these and piled them up, and word of this reached the school about which we had already been warned. However, at the main assembly in front of the whole school, we were well and truly chastised, both by the headmaster and the local police. The WVS ran a canteen for Canadians at the Memorial Hall, and can remember some delicious meat pies which we were able to acquire. The social life of the junction revolved around the Memorial Hall, Girl Guides, Boy Scouts, church services and Sunday School, Women's Institute. A concert party was formed and shows were laid on for the Canadians. They also put on film shows which we were able to attend. This is a wartime photograph of the Girl Covenanters at the Memorial Hall. The first four girls from the left in the front are evacuees. This one here, June Crane, I remember having a youthful crush on. My sister is there. And this is a photograph of the Women's Institute at the Memorial Hall. My mother is there, and Miss Poupart is there. During the war, my brother volunteered for the services, in fact the Navy, and he was signed up to the Fleet Air Arm, onto the aircraft carrier HMS Implacable. Lord and Lady Waterhouse lived at Orchard Farm, a large Tudor-style mansion in a landscape garden with an outside swimming pool. The estate comprised farmland and orchards. One day there were horses in the field, and my friend, who was keen on horses, who even looked the part, dressed in riding breeches, carried a rope around, and he harnessed one of these horses and rode galloped across the field. He unwillingly coaxed me onto one, gave me the whack on the rump. I went charging across the field, the horse pulled up sharply and I went flying over its head. Not being one for taking for a ride, falling for a fast one, I thought never again. Lord Waterhouse, a chartered accountant, had a business in London, which is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. They made a bungalow available for evacuee accommodation under the auspices of an appointed governess who insisted on being formally addressed. She called us all by our surnames and she liked to be called Madam. Rather officious. Anyway, we had some good times there, playing in the fields, barns and haystacks. We collected loads of Cox's orange apples, stored them for Christmas. And Lady Waterhouse laid on a Christmas party for the evacuees and their friends. And I remember we all sat at a long table loaded with goodies in the big house, and a good time was had by all. The year was probably 1940. Hit tune of the day was I Got Spurs, That Jingle Jangle Jingle, and the current film screened was The Petrified Forest. When my brother was demobbed after the war, he purchased a double-barreled 12-bore shotgun. And several of us used to go over the common with a dog and some ferrets and shooting rabbits and pheasants. And I remember we had to cross the railway line and step over two live rails to get to a field where some rabbits were. Another chance to earn some extra pocket money during the war was scraping the blackout paint off the railway carriage windows in the railway sheds. Music was important to me and still is. During the war, I was given several gramophones. I remember two portables and a cabinet one. And the first one was one with a horn, similar to the one that HMV advertised with the dog in front, Nipper. The spring had broken and I used to persevere turning the turntable with my finger in order to get the right speed. Another pastime was making crystal sets. And I remember lying in bed with headphones on, twiddling the cat's whisker to get a loud spot on the crystal and picking up Lord Haw-Haw, William Joyce, Germany Calling. And of course, during the war, it was part of the swing era with the big bands, Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Benny Goodman. I was into all that stuff. For me, it was a very interesting musical period. Effingham Cricket Club. I remember the club pre-war, walking to the ground on a sunny Sunday afternoon, straight from Sunday school, and seeing a marquee with teas laid out on trestle tables inside. Also, for some reason, the pitch was transferred temporarily to a field further along the main road at the bottom of the hill on the right-hand side. And remember, a double-winged aircraft made a forced landing there. An anti-aircraft ACAT unit took over the ground during the war, and afterwards, working parties, including Italian prisoners of war labour, worked to reinstate the ground, cutting back undergrowth, etc. This is a photograph of a painting done by an artist friend of our president, Dr. Sutton, showing a working party clearing the undergrowth. In the background you can see two trees. That's where the Malamadelas lived. I was associated with the club both as a playing member and match secretary for some 25 years. Our first president, I remember, was Bill Shepherd, a builder, who lived in Surrey Gardens. And we all envied him at the time because he was the only member who owned a car, a Rover. Committee meetings were sometimes held in the Plough Inn at Effingham Village, run by Jimmy Handley and his wife, actor and film star, and seen on the television series Jim's Inn. One of our meetings there was terminated after a visit from Diana Dawes and her boyfriend Tommy Yeardye. The ground originally had no pavilion, just a refreshment hut with a hinged pull-down counter and a shed to house the Dennis Motormower, which at times was very reluctant to start. Water for tea was boiled in a copper, tea urn, on a paraffin stove. The urn had to be filled from an outside tap situated in Adrian Essler's field nearby, and where his rather hostile cow grazed. After cautiously filling the urn, the two carriers, Tommy Hall and Nobby Penfold, returned somewhat quicker than they went, chased by the cow. This is a 1950s photo of the club. Back row, left to right, Harry Trish, secretary, John Irvin, Reg Carey, Fred Donison, Adrian Essler, A.N. Other, Peter Topper, Maurice Waller. Front row, right to left, Nobby Penfold, Tommy Hall, myself, Peter Drew, Michael Topper. Late 1950s photo, back row, left to right, Hamish Brown, Arthur Penfold, myself, Adrian Essler, Connell Hall, Ross Tester. Front row, right to left, Alan Hull, Nobby Penfold, Tommy Hall, John Hawkey. This photograph, taken about 1963 is when newer members started to come into the club and take over. Back row, left to right, Ross Tester, A.N. Other, Frank Sparling, Peter Collett, Morris Waller, Philip Dixon, myself, Ken Osborne. Front row, right to left, Ken Moore, Chris Williams, Brian Salton, Alan Brown and Keith Jones. Apart from Murray, the wicket and the outfield, a roller had to be pulled and pushed, which was a heavy cast iron roller filled with concrete, very hard going. Elson closets were housed in two rusting corrugated iron sheds for the WCs, very uninviting and unhygienic. Behind the bushes became the more popular option. Adrian Essler, a larger-than-life character and member, lived and owned land adjacent to the club. A tall, imposing tree surgeon who didn't mince his words. He was of German origin and was public school educated at Aldall College. He was also part of the local hunt scene. He had his own personal cricketing dress code, generally batting at number 10 or 11, and sometimes he scored the odd run. He wore a Panama hat, open neck shirt with long flapping unbuttoned sleeves, no socks or pads, and his boots had seen better days. The bat resembled a matchstick in his hands, but he possessed a profound knowledge of the rules of cricket, causing some disquiet at times about his umpiring decisions, but certainly no argument. Latterly, his brother Mervyn, a quieter and more reserved gentleman, came to live with Adrian. Homemade dams in wine was one of his specialities, and when invited into his farmhouse kitchen for a tasting, along with hunks of bread and cheese, the bottles, when opened, were still fermenting. His Rolls-Royce van, complete with starting handles, carried his tools of trade, and the bolted doors often jammed. At one local away match, we arrived in style in his horse and trap. He did at one time, I remember, have a very attractive wife who I met one Christmas while carol singing there. Adrian and Dr. Sutton did not always see eye to eye on certain issues, and to show his displeasure at something about which Dr. Sutton instigated, he allowed his horse to tramp over the wicket, causing damaging hoof prints. There were some Sunday home games which attracted quite a few spectators, with cars lined up along the approach road. The collection box became a useful fundraiser. One American tourist walked over to the wicket wanting to take photos while play was in progress. Dr. Sutton started a pavilion fund, getting donations from many sources, which eventually financed the acquisition of a cedarwood sectional pavilion, complete with changing room, kitchen, bar and toilets. This was erected by members and opened in the mid-60s. Our independence by acquiring a license to sell alcohol deprived the Lord Howard of our once after-match custom. This photograph of the Cricket Club Pavilion was taken in September 2010. It's looking rather sorry for itself, needing a lot of maintenance. If the Dr. Sutton had been alive today, I don't think he would be very enamoured with the present situation. My brother was actively very much involved with the club for 50 years, involving much hard work. He and Dr. Sutton were in legal negotiations with the Lord of the Manor in securing the future tenure of the club. My brother latterly formed the club into a company, whose wife, my sister-in-law, was also involved for 50 years making the teas and the catering arrangements. This is a plaque I did to commemorate my brother's 50 years association with Effingham Cricket Club. It's hanging up behind the bar in the pavilion. Horsley Towers. Horsley Towers was originally owned by Sopwith the Aviator. It later became a girls' school, and during the war years it was the headquarters of the Central Electricity Board. So it merits inclusion for its close links with the Effinghams by employing staff from there, including myself, brother and sister. And where time was enjoyed, using its sporting and leisure facilities, out with working hours, and so a lot of time was spent there. This is a replica cottage to the one I lived in at Effingham Junction, which managed to get a reprieve. One half was demolished. It's situated at Station Approach, East Horsley. This is the last and final photograph I took of Station Cottages in 1966. I flew the nest in 1968 on getting married, having lived at number 2 for 34 happy years. I consider myself extremely privileged and fortunate to have lived and been raised in a God-fearing, secure family environment at Effingham Junction. My father died in 1972. My mother carried on living there for a further 12 years or so prior to moving into sheltered accommodation in Bookham. My brother took me back there for a nostalgic visit prior to it being demolished, and it was then empty and rather dilapidated. It proved to be a rather sad experience. Following this is a video taken in 2003 of a car ride from Forest Road, East Horsley, through to Effingham Village. It is noted that the Lord Howard Public House is no longer there and has been replaced by a block of flats.